welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. We are wrapping up today. We should wrap up the Pennsylvania ratification debates. And as you know, this show is also sponsored by RepublicReview.org. This really is the only show that goes through the academic evidence, and these ratification debates are that academic evidence that will actually prove how the Constitution was defined and the terms and limitations of the compact and how they were laid out to the parties. Remember, only the states are the parties to the compact. Only they can determine whether their constitution is being violated or not. The Supreme Court is supposed to only look at whether something is within their jurisdiction or not, and if it is those things that, you know, in the case before them, are those things stipulated, are they implied within the compact or not? Being a Supreme Court justice is not that difficult. The problem is that they have aggrandized their position over the Constitution when, in actuality, there's never been an amendment granting the Supreme Court the ability to amend or make anything that is not defined in the Constitution constitutional. Healthcare, abortion, marriage, they have reached in and pulled these things underneath federal jurisdiction when there is no jurisdiction whatsoever in the Constitution for those issues. That you can't even backdoor into a particular issue. Let's just say a person is, you know, they have a, they just got, a homosexual couple just got married, and their rights to the Second Amendment are being violated, so they go into court over the Second Amendment, and then it gets up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court then pulls in this ancillary argument of homosexuality. They can't do it. They have to view this very specific infractions of the compact. And so bottom line, I had a good conversation this past weekend with a Constitution Party chair, and it comes down to this. The Supreme Court should have passed. Now, so let me just be clear. Whenever somebody comes to you and says, we want to, you know, we want you to have jurisdiction over this, something that you have no power over. In other words, here's an opportunity to aggrandize your power. Well, it flies in the face of reason why any lustful person, a person with avarice for power and responsibility, wouldn't want to be able to aggrandize their power. Bottom line is the Constitution doesn't allow it. It's really that simple. And so the states, the state legislatures, they have to be the one to take the stand and say, sorry, we never delegated that power to you. Now, as we kind of move forward, I just want to remind you, we do have our comment line, 24/7, 365-425-270-5416. And as we look at what's going on around us, I know we could easily get caught into constitutional conversations with what this unconstitutional this constitutional crisis with an unconstitutional president that we're dealing with. But now is not the time. Now we really want to just really focus on Pennsylvania. Once we're done with Pennsylvania, we're going to dive into Massachusetts. But actually, before we dive into Massachusetts, I have to once again explain, and I ask you to please forgive me. We had everything laid out, but for some reason, the South Carolina debates were not played consecutively like they were supposed to be played. And so we basically missed it. I know for a fact at least one. And so I believe it ended up being two debates or two shows that were missed in the time I was absent. And forgive me, I had a surgery, so I had to kind of stack the deck to allow myself to let this air, you know, the shows air to a point where I can actually be up and about and start continuing on with the shows. And now that I'm in that point, we're going to have to replay the South Carolina shows this week. And then starting on Monday, we will pick up with Massachusetts. And Massachusetts is a very, very special ratification debate because their tone is far more spiritual than any of the other debates. Not that Pennsylvania didn't get spiritual, and not that all of them didn't get spiritual. You could tell when it came down to finalizing arguments and their view of the Constitution, their view of the Union, and everything else, it was the tone and the undertones were on a spiritual connotation. So I think you'll find it pretty interesting. And oh, by the way, they actually cover some things that do not get covered in some of the other debates. At least I've never found these types of elucidations regarding the Constitution, but we will get into that next week. And so where we left off, Mr. Wilson, it was Tuesday, December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. Just remember, Pearl Harbor hadn't happened yet. And Mr. Wilson was kind of going through another long iteration of his oration. And so what he was just now getting into is the supreme law of the land. And so this is how it goes. There is no doubt, sir, but under this Constitution, treaties will become the supreme law of the land. Nor is there any doubt, but the Senate and President possess the power of making them. But though the treaties are to have the force of laws, they are, in some important respects, very different from other acts of legislation. In making laws, our own consent alone is necessary. In forming treaties, the concurrence of another power becomes necessary. Treaties, sir, are truly contracts or compacts between the two different states, nations, or princes who find it convenient or necessary to enter into them. Some gentlemen are of an opinion that the power of making treaties should have been placed in the legislature at large. There are, however, reasons that operate with great force on the other side. Treaties are frequently, especially in times of war, such a nature that it would be extremely improper to publish them or even commit the secret of their negotiation to any great number of persons. For my part, I am not an advocate for secrecy in transactions relating to the public, not generally in forming treaties, because I think that the history of the diplomatic corps will evince, even in that great department of politics, the truth of the old adage that honesty is the best policy. And this is the conduct of the most able negotiators, yet sometimes secrecy may be necessary. And therefore, it becomes an argument against committing the knowledge of these transactions to too many persons. But their nature in treaties originate differently from laws. They are made by equal parties, and each side has half of the bargain to make. They will be made between us and powers of distances of 3,000 miles. That's kind of short-sighted, but anyway, I don't know why he came up with 3,000 miles other than, you know, Britain and the crowns or the nations of Europe. But anyway, a long series of negotiation will frequently precede them, and can it be the opinion of these gentlemen that the legislature should, in session during this whole time? It well deserves to be remarked, because remember, the House of Representatives is not in session for the entire year. It well deserves to be remarked that though the House of Representatives possesses no active part in making treaties, yet their legislative authority will be found to have strong restraining influences upon both President and Senate. In England, if the king and his ministers find themselves during their negotiation to be embarrassed because of an existing law is not repealed or a new law is not enacted, they give notice to the legislature of their situation and inform them that it will be necessary before the treaty can operate that some law be repealed or some be made. And will it not be the same thing taking place here? shall less prudence, less caution, less moderation take place among those who negotiate treaties for the United States than among those who negotiate them for the other nations of the earth? And let it be attended to that even in the making of treaties, the states are immediately represented in the Senate, because that's who represents, that's who's being represented in the Senate. And the people immediately represented to the two constituent parties of the government must concur in making them. Neither the president nor the Senate solely can complete a treaty. They are checks upon each other and are so balanced as to produce security to the people. So, interesting perspective, but he kind of gives you a really good insight, and it's kind of similar to what we've already seen with South Carolina. In other words, as we start looking at this concept of treaties, this concept of checks and balances, the concept of delegated powers, we're not finding, and you will not find anything that contradicts what I have been telling you, that the states are the parties to the compact, and that the states have the control over this constitution because they have delegated very specific powers to the general government, and only those powers is where the general government's jurisdiction ends. So we will be back with a little bit more from Pennsylvania, actually a lot more. So we'll be right back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure. In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL. Or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
So here's a real interesting point, and I don't think I've ever shared this in any of the readings of the ratification debates, but in Pennsylvania, there was an assertion that the president would become a tool of the Senate. And so the fact that they actually used that, because, I mean, calling somebody a tool today is you know, still common vernacular. But anyway, this is what Mr. Wilson said. If gentlemen will look into this article and read for themselves, they will find that there is no well-grounded reason to suspect the president will be the tool of the Senate.
The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officers in each of the executive departments upon any subject relative to the duties of their respective offices. And he shall have power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States. Must the president, after all, be called the tool of the Senate? I do not mean to insinuate that he has more powers than he ought to have, but merely to declare that they are of such a nature as to place him above expression of contempt. There is another power of no small magnitude entrusted in this officer. He shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed, close quote. So, kind of interesting how there was, and this, I believe, was the only ratification debate where they kind of took that paradigm of perspective. So that's why it's important to read all of them. Now, in this next one, this is really kind of jurisdiction, common law, kind of combined in this oration. And again, it's Mr. Wilson, and this is still on December 7th. And the power of having appellate jurisdiction as to facts has been insisted upon as a proof, quote, that the convention intended to give up the trial by jury in civil cases and to introduce the civil law. I have already declared for my opinion on this point and have shown not merely that it is founded on reason and authority, the express declaration of Congress, Journals of Congress, March 6, 1779, is to the same purpose. They insisted upon this power as requisite to preserve the peace of the Union. Certainly, therefore, it ought always to be possessed by the head of the Confederacy. We are told as an additional proof that the trial by jury was intended to be given up, quote, that appeals are known to the common law, that the term is a civil law term, and with it, the civil law is intended to be introduced, close quote. I confess, I was a good deal surprised at this observation being made for Blackstone in the very volume which the honorable member, Mr. Smiley, had in his hands and read several extracts from this chapter entitled, quote, of proceeding in the nature of appeals, close quote, and in that chapter says that the principal method for redress or of redress for erroneous judgments in the King's Court of Record is by writ of error or some superior, quote, court of appeal, close quote. Now, it is well known that his book is a commentary upon common law. Here, then, is a strong refutation of the assertion, quote, that appeals are unknown to the common law, close quote. One of the things, because we actually talk a bit about common law, because common law grand juries are a tool that we have to start using in getting government officials at the local, state, and federal level back into compliance. And so we can use common law grand juries to actually do this. But so if you want to read a good commentary on common law, then Blackstone is probably where you want to go. And so, and it's, let me see here. Do I have a name for this? No. They just talk about the chapter of proceedings of the nature of appeals. You may want to just look for that. And it says actually number 3, Blackstone 406, which is probably the page number. But anyway, moving on, Mr. Wilson starts addressing the militia. And he basically says this: I believe the power of raising and keeping up an army in time of peace is essential to every government. No government can secure its citizens against dangers internal and external without possessing it and sometimes carrying it into execution. I confess it is a power in the exercise of which all wise and moderate governments will be as prudent and forbearing as possible. When we consider the situation of the United States, we must be satisfied that it will be necessary to keep up some troops for the protection of the western frontiers and to secure our interests in the internal navigation of the country. It will not only be necessary, but it will be economical on the great scale. Our enemies, finding us invulnerable, will not attack us, and we shall thus prevent the occasion for larger standing armies. I am now led to consider another charge that is brought against this system. It is said the Congress should not possess the power of calling out the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions, nor the President have the command of them when called out for such purpose. I believe any gentleman who possesses military experience will inform you that men without a uniformity of arms, accoutrements, and discipline are no more than a mob in a camp, that in the field, instead of assisting, they interfere with one another. If a soldier drops his musket and his companion, unfurnished with one, takes it up, it is of no service because his cartridges do not fit it by means of this system. A uniformity of arms and discipline will prevail throughout the United States. I really expect that for this part of the system, at least, the framers of it would have received plaudits instead of censures, as they here discover a strong anxiety to have this body put upon an effective footing and thereby, in a great measure, to supersede the necessity of raising and keeping up standing armies. Do you see this interusing of the words armies and militia? And as a matter of fact, as he talked about having armies in the Western territories, those armies would have been comprised of the militias being federalized. What ended up happening was they started creating a spoil system by creating the cavalry and creating positions and creating opportunities of politics and intrigue. And so even though they figured out some ways of skirting, it wasn't until the Civil War where they truly skirted the militia. But they did downplay the militia as much as possible so that they could maintain these ranks of these forts going across the United States into the western regions and so forth. Anyway, he goes on and says, the militia formed under this system and trained by the several states will be such a bulwark of internal strength as to prevent the attacks of foreign enemies. I have been told that about the year 1744, an attack was intended upon France upon Massachusetts Bay, but was given up on the reading the militia law of the province. And so, if a single state could deter an enemy from such attempts, what influence will the proposed arrangement have upon the different powers of Europe? In every point of view, this regulation is called to produce good effects. How powerful and respectable must the body of militia appear under general and uniform regulations? How disjointed, weak, and inefficient are they at present? I appeal to military experience for the truth of my observations. And then he goes into his next observation. And so this next one is where Mr. McKean actually steps forward and he starts talking in a long oration. And so what we're going to do is basically kind of cover, you know, his introduction on enumerated powers. And so he says thusly. As a matter of fact, let me just pause. I got about a minute and a half, so let me just go ahead and I'll read until we get to the next break. The framers of the Constitution wisely divided the legislative department between the two houses, subject on the qualified negative of the President of the United States, though this government embraces only enumerated powers. In a single state, annual elections may be proper, the more so when the legislative powers extend to all cases, but in such an extent of a country as the United States, and when the powers are circumscribed, there is not that necessity, nor are the objects of the general government of that nature to be acquired immediately by every capacity. To combine the various interests of 13 different states requires more extensive knowledge than is necessary for the legislature of any one of them. 2 years are therefore little enough for members of the House of Representatives to make themselves fully acquainted with the views and habits and interests of the United States. With respect to the Senate, when we consider the trust reposed in them, we cannot hesitate to pronounce that the period assigned to them is short enough. They possess, in common with the House of Representatives, legislative power. With its concurrence, they also have power to declare war. They are joined with the president in concluding treaties. It therefore behooves them to be of a conversant with politics of the nations of the world and the dispositions of the sovereigns and their ministers. This requires much reading and attention. And we'll take a pause right there. We're going to go into these two breaks, and we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
Don't forget, you can call our 24-hour comment line to ask a question or to speak on any topic. Dial 425-270-5416. Okay, and so Mr. McKean is kind of putting his own spin on the representation of the legislative branch. And it's obvious, folks, that they don't really mince words here. When they talk about the legislatures are the sovereigns. They're the ones that are creating the laws. Anyway, he goes on and says, "And believe me, the longer a man bends his study to any particular subject, the more likely he is to be master of it. Experience and practice will assist genius and education." Sorry. "I therefore think the time allowed under this system to both houses to be extremely proper. This objection has been made repeatedly, but it can only have weight with those who are not at the pains of thinking on the subject. When anything, sir, new or great is done, it is very apt to create a ferment among those out of doors who, as they cannot always enter into the depth and wisdom of counsels, are too apt to censure what they do not understand. Upon a little reflection and experience, the people can often find that to be a singular blessing, which is at first they deemed a curse." Kind of interesting, but if you look at today and how people aren't even, becoming experts. Remember Gore? Remember Gore, when Gore made the assertion of climate change and all of that? I mean, this guy knew nothing. He became a champion. Let me just focus on what he did. He became a champion on trying to engage in something that was erroneously derived. And what I believe we really need to have is we need to have laws that anybody who has political influence or public influence, rock star or actor, news commentator, national news anchor, politician, it doesn't matter. If you get out and you start using demagoguery and these wild assertions that, you know, we're going to die, that, you know, these, we're all going to drown on the coastlines because of the ice melt and all of these just terrible lies. And what if they say, if Gore comes out and says by 2020 or by the year 2000, you know, we're going to be losing our coastal cities, and that doesn't happen, and the evidence actually proves otherwise, that there's not even really been a major rise in the sea level, then what should happen is Gore should be charged for trying to incite fear and panic amongst the public. It's like going into a theater and yelling fire. But these guys get away with it because instead of saying fire, they say, there's going to be fire. There's going to be fire. Without any, you know, without having to substantiate or prove anything. And then there is no recourse and no action. If we have a society of liberty, then we have to have a society that holds people accountable for what they assert. And so, anyway, I digress because, you know, he was basically kind of talking about becoming learned on a subject and so forth, but that doesn't eliminate demagoguery from the ranks of public officials and or people who have public influence or political influence. Anyway, this is Mr. McKean's view on the militia. It is objected that the powers of Congress are too large because, quote, they have the power of calling forth the militia on necessary occasions and may call them from one end of the continent to the other and wantonly harass them. Besides, they may coerce men to act in the militia whose consciences are against bearing arms in any case, close quote. It is true, by the system, power is given to Congress to organize, arm, and discipline the militia. But everything else is left to the state governments. They are to officer and train them. Congress have also the power of calling them forth for the purpose of executing the laws of the Union, suppressing insurrections, and repelling invasions. But can it be supposed that they could call them in such case from Georgia to New Hampshire? Common sense must oppose this idea. Now he speaks a little bit on the necessary and proper. Another objection, because literally this is just a break between him talking about the militia, and then he goes, and another objection was taken from these words of the Constitution. Quote, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or any other department or office thereof, close quote. And in declaring, quote, that the Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof and all treaties made or shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, close quote. This at last has been conceded that though it is explicit enough, yet it gives to Congress no further powers than those already enumerated. These two clauses do not provide any general powers. They only provide the explanation that they can make laws to carry out the execution of these laws, of these powers. Anyway, that those that first said it gave Congress the power of superseding the state governments cannot persist in it. For no person can, with a tolerable face, read the clause over and infer that such may be the consequence. Ta-da! He moves on and talks more about enumerated powers and jurisdiction. That in all cases enumerated, except where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, quote, they have appeal of jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with that such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Now here's my problem with the Supreme Court making fact. If they are not using the ratification debates and how the ratification debates delineated, defined, and clarified what they can do, what they can't do, so forth and so on, and they're just making these things up, then it has to be dismissed. Everything that the Supreme Court makes rulings on must be pointing to these founding documents, these ratification debates, these legal appendages to the Constitution. And he goes on and says this. This is Mr. McKean. From this, it is inferred that by the trial by jury is not secured and an objection is set up to the system because they have jurisdiction between citizens of different states. Regulations under this head are necessary, but the convention could form no one that would have suited each of the United States. It has been a subject of amazement to me to hear gentlemen contend that the verdict of a jury shall be without revision in all cases. Juries are not infallible because they are 12 in number. But when the law is so blended with the fact as to be inseparable, may not the decision of a jury be erroneous? Yet notwithstanding, this trial by jury is the best mode that is known. Appeal of jurisdiction, sir, is known by the common law, and causes are removed from inferior courts by writs of error into some court of appeal. It is said that the Lord Chancellor in all cases sends down to the lower courts when he wants to determine a fact, but that opinion is not well founded, because he determines 19 out of 20 without the intervention of any jury. The power to try causes between citizens of different states was thought by some gentlemen invidious, but I apprehend they must see the necessity of it from what has already been said by my honorable colleague, Mr. Wilson. He goes on and says that there is no bill of declaration of rights in this Constitution. To this I answer, such a thing has not been deemed essential to liberty, excepting in Great Britain, where there is a king and a House of Lords quite distinct with respect to power and interest from the rest of the people. Or in Poland, the Pacta Conventus with the king signs before he is crowned, and in six states of the American United States. Again, because it is unnecessary for the powers of Congress being derived from the people in the mode pointed out in this Constitution and being therein enumerated and positively granted can be no other than what this positive grant conveys. And he cites John Locke on Civil Government, Volume 2, Book 2, Chapter 2, Section 140, and the 13th chapter, Section 152. And then he wraps up on this concept of delegated powers. With respect to executive officers, they have no manner of authority, any of them, beyond what is by positive grant and commission delegated to them in those enumerated powers. Quote, that this is a consolidation of several states and not a confederation. And so it's kind of interesting how they point these things out. To this answer, the name is immaterial. The thing unites the several states and makes them like one, in particular instances for particular purposes, which is ardently desired by most of the sensible men of this country. I care not whether it is a consolidated confederation or a national government or by what other name. If it is a good government and calculated to promote the blessings of liberty, tranquility, and happiness. And I'll just kind of inject right here, because they didn't have, at their time, they didn't have a good understanding of a term hybrid, where you have kind of a mixture of one system and another system to create even a greater system. This is what we have. We have a hybrid constitutional republic, not a confederation, not a federation, but a mixture of both. Anyway, we'll be right back after these two promos.
If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me. AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADD-LOCAL or visit them on the web at www.addlocal.com. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so where we are right now is where Mr. McKeon is making his final kind of arguments, and what he's doing is he's actually reading these questions. So as to what he said earlier, that this is a consolidation of the several states and not a confederation, close quote. So what he's doing is he's kind of reading comments by others in the forum that are, you know, making these one little, you know, assertions or so forth. And so the next one is, it is an aristocracy and was intended to be so by the framers of it. And so he reads that quote and then he responds. And so at this point in time, he's really wrapping up and he's going to kind of give you a summary of what and how he sees this new form of government. And to this comment, it is an aristocracy and was intended to be so by the framers of it, close quote. Here again, sir, the name is immaterial if it be a good system of government for the general and common concerns of the United States. But after the definition which has already been given of an aristocratic government, it becomes unnecessary to repeat arguments to prove that this system does not establish an aristocracy. There have been some other objections to, or rather criticisms on, this work, which I rest assured the gentleman who made them will, on reflection, excuse me in omitting to notice. Many parts of this Constitution have been wrested and tortured in order to make way for shadowy objections, which must have been observed by every auditor. Some other things were said with acrimony, bitterness or spite. Some things have been said with bitterness or spite. They seem to be personal. I heard the sound, but it was inarticulate. I can compare it to nothing better than the feeble noise occasioned by the working of small beer. It holds in argument, as well as nature, that destructio unusus est grandioto alertus, a Latin for what the refutation of an argument begets a proof. The objection to this constitution has been answered and all done away. It remains pure and unhurt, and it alone is forcible argument of its goodness. Mr. President, I am sure nothing can prevail me with to give my vote for ratifying this constitution, but a conviction from comparing the arguments on both sides that not doing it is liable to more inconvenience and danger than doing it. One, if you do it, you strengthen the government and the people of the United States and will thereby have the wisdom and assistance of all the states. Two, you will settle, establish, and firmly perpetuate our independence by destroying the vain hopes of all of its enemies, both at home and abroad. Three, you will encourage your allies to join with you, nay, to depend that which had been stipulated or shall hereafter be stipulated and agreed upon, will be punctual performed, and other nations will be induced to enter into treaties with you. Four, it will have a tendency to break our parties and divisions and, by that means, lay a firm and solid foundation for the future tranquility and happiness of the United States in general and of this state in particular. Five, it will invigorate our commerce and encourage shipbuilding. Six, it will have a tendency not only to prevent any other nation from making war upon you, but from offering you any wrong or even insult. In short, the advantages that must result from it are obviously so numerous and important and have been so fully and ably pointed out by others that it appears to be unnecessary to enlarge upon this head. Upon the whole, sir, the law has been my study from my infancy and my only profession. I have gone through the circle of offices in the legislative, executive, and judicial departments of government, and from my study, observation, and experience, I must declare that from a full examination and due consideration of this system, it appears to me to be the best the world has yet seen. I congratulate you on the fair prospect of its being adopted, and I am happy in the expectation of seeing accomplished what has been long my ardent wish, that you will hereafter have a salutary permanency in the magistracy and stability in the laws. Now, what we have now is some amendments that were proposed regarding the Constitution, because they actually did make some suggestions for the Constitution. And so the jurisdiction amendment first, and so this is the one that kind of talks about it, that Congress shall not exercise any powers whatever, but those such are expressly given to that body by the Constitution of the United States, nor shall any authority or jurisdiction be assumed or exercised by the executive or judiciary departments of the Union under color or pretense of construction or fiction by all the rights of sovereignty which are not by the said Constitution expressly and plainly vested in the Congress shall be deemed to remain with and shall be exercised by the several states in the Union according to the respective constitutions, and that every reserve of the rights of individuals made by the several constitutions and the states of the Union to the citizens and inhabitants of each state respectively shall remain inviolate except so far as they are expressly and manifestly yielded or narrowed by the national constitution. So this next one is a exclusive legislative amendment. Section 8, subsection 7, that the clause respecting the exclusive legislation over a district not exceeding 10 miles square be qualified by provisio that such right of legislation extended only to such regulations as respect the police and good order thereof. And then the final amendment that they made of Section 8, Subsection 8, that each state respectively shall have power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia thereof, whensoever Congress shall admit or neglect to provide for the same, that the militia shall not be subject to Okay, so that was a period there. Congress shall not omit or neglect or provide for the same, period. That the militia, so the new kind of thought or new topic, that the militia shall not be subject to martial law, but when in actual service in the time of war, invasion, or rebellion, and when not in the actual service of the United States, shall be subject to such fines, penalties, and punishments only as shall be directed or inflicted by the laws of its own state, nor shall the militia of any state be continued in actual service longer than 2 months under any call of Congress without the consent of the legislature of each state in their recesses, the executive authority thereof. And so, as you can tell, this one particular amendment wasn't really grasped or given. And as a matter of fact, this is very similar to some of George Mason's concerns that he basically brought forth in the Virginia ratification debates. And this was really clarified even more, because here they're basically making an amendment to ensure that the militia shall not be subject to martial law. Well, okay. Well, why is that important? Because when you declare martial law, that means that your rights and those things that are protected by the law, your right of religious expression, your right of speech, and so forth, those things cannot be taken away until they declare martial law. And in the Virginia ratifications, they get into the details of what it really takes to be able to declare martial law under this new system, with the militia being the integral part of executing all laws and all orders and so forth. And so, my friends, this is why it is so important to really grasp and understand what we have in front of us with this Constitution. And the only way to do this, the only way to clearly understand what each line of the Constitution meant, was by reading these ratification debates, because they get into these lines. And when we come back next week, because when we come back tomorrow, we're going to be airing, once again, the South Carolina debates. Forgive me, but I just want to make sure that all three are kind of heard in sequence, so that moving forward, when we go into the Massachusetts debates, which has a completely different tone, as I've told you, they try to go through this line by line. They actually try, in Massachusetts, they try to do this. And Massachusetts was the first state to offer up amendments to the Constitution as a part of their ratification. Jefferson saw this when he was in France, and he goes, "This is awesome!" I mean, he says, "Now I completely embrace the ratification of the Constitution." Prior to that, he said, "I don't think we should be ratifying this quickly." He felt it needed a Bill of Rights. But as he saw what Massachusetts had done, then he felt that that was ample in putting to aside the concerns of a Bill of Rights. Now, again, he didn't understand the Constitution, and we'll get into that more later. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show
in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.